This podcast is produced in part by Podfly.net. Podfly, passion for great sounding podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are not necessarily those of Overseas Radio Network or broadcast partners. All information provided is for educational purposes only. Before taking action, consult a licensed professional.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
This week on Columbia Calling with me, your host Richard McCall, we're talking to journalist and Fulbright scholar Kira Gurney, resident of New Mexico, now living in Bogota. We're going to talk about her work as a journalist, and I really want to tune in to some of the stuff, the really insightful and informative pieces that she's done here for the City Paper in Bogota about the peace dialogues, about the economics of kidnapping and in fact, releasing the hostages, and of course social media when it comes to talking about the FARC guerrilla. So we'll be talking about this and many more topics on Columbia Calling with me, your host, Richard McCall, on the Overseas Radio Network. Tune in.
The world is a beautiful place, so listen up. The Overseas Radio Network.
We know you want to grow your business and directly engage your customers and clientele. Podcasting is the way to go, and Podfly has your solution. Whether you're a blogger, writer, business owner, entrepreneur, or service provider, Podfly makes it easy for anyone to have a professionally produced and distributed podcast. Get started today at podfly.net, and let's get your message truly heard. Podfly.net, passion for great sounding podcasts.
Ready to learn about a new life overseas? You're at the right place. This is the Overseas Radio Network.
Good afternoon. It's Columbia Calling with me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota. Those of you who listen frequently will know you'll know that I came back from the coast after 2 months there away, running my little hotel, La Casa Maria in Mompós, watching the restorations taking place in town. If you want to see more about this, just check out the City Paper of Bogota. I've written an opinion piece about the restorations taking place, and basically it's a great big call and a thank you to the Ministry of Culture for intervening in our town. And sometimes I think about why there are so many people against the restorations and renovations. And well, I have to put myself in their shoes, and perhaps if these people are in academia and they see that something's being done that doesn't follow the colonial line or the original atmosphere of the town, I can understand. But it just seems as if people are complaining for the desire and the wish no more than to complain. What do you want? What do you want from all of this? Why are you complaining that we're paving the main plaza? If you want it returned to the colonial splendor, then of course it would be unpaved and we'd be in a muddy swamp of a plaza that we wouldn't be able to walk in. We have moved on. The town needs to be protected. And I guess, you know, this is something that we talk about, and it's always raised when they're talking about UNESCO World Heritage Sites, and my little town of Mompós is no different, really. I mean, the town had been forgotten for years, for decades, for centuries, really. And finally, the Ministry of Culture, UNESCO, European Union, the Dutch Prince Klaus Fund, they've all put money towards it. And the people, the workers, are working overtime. You'll see them working on Saturdays and Sundays. They've got to get it ready. And I says, it's what the town needs. The town needs to be pulled out of its slumber. And I understand if some things don't resemble as, let's say, authentic as they might be for a colonial town. Equally, the townspeople who have lived in this state of abandon for so long also have the right to some modernity and to some sort of cleanliness and to some order. I can't leave it in this state of collapse that after the floods of 2010 and 2011, we can't leave it like that. It will be a UNESCO World Heritage Site that will then lose its UNESCO World Heritage status. So anyway, so I wrote an editorial about that that you can see in February's City Paper, the citypaperbogota.com. And that brings me quite neatly to the topic of this week's interview, this week's show. I'm talking to Kira Gurney, who's a journalist for the City Paper. She's a trainee journalist, but I would say she's already well on her way to becoming a star. This bright young thing moved to Colombia at the age of 22. She got a Fulbright scholar to go off and teach at the university in Boyacá in the city of Tunja. Tunja is an incredibly colonial city, one of the key Spanish cities in the sort of colonization of this part of northern South America. And yes, incredible museums and churches, but very undervisited because it's a crossroads of coming between Bogota and the touristic town of Villa de Leyva, which is about 3.5 hours from Bogota in total. So people don't stop in Tunja. And so Kira, this young lady, lived there for a whole year. And I guess she was sort of she would have noticed that it wasn't a tourist destination anyway. That would have been to her benefit, being, just I think there were one of two American girls living there last year. So what an experience, age 22, coming out to Colombia, she'll be talking about her time in Tunja. She worked for an NGO there in Tunja in her spare time, and was teaching English at the university. So, I mean, just imagine that. Put yourself in her shoes, age 22, going out to Tunja in rural Colombia and this to work. And anyway, now she's living in Bogota, and she's writing for the City Paper. You may remember that some months ago, one of the first interviews that we did on Colombia Calling was with the editor of the City Paper, the owner, the director, the editor, Richard Emblem, one of the great interviews that we've done. So you can check that out on iTunes in our Colombia Calling file there. You can find the interview. Oh, it's still pertinent today, I have to add. Anyway, so we're talking to Kira, and you know what? She'll make an interesting case, and I want to raise not only her time in Tunja, but talk about some of the articles that she's written, because this girl is informed. Now she's 23 years old, and she really knows what's going on. I've talked about the kidnapping and then subsequent release of Kevin Scott Sute, the former U.S. Marine, who went off against everyone's better, pleading with him. Everyone pleaded with him not to walk off into the jungles, and he did so in Guaviare and promptly got kidnapped and taken hostage by the FARC guerrillas. Anyways, Kira wrote an incredibly interesting article about that, which you can see online at the City Paper at Bogota.com. It deals with the economics of a rescue of a hostage. And think about it, that the International Red Cross, of course, have the belief that there is no maximum price to pay for rescuing someone, and that's fine, and that's their belief, and that's I think that's right. A human life, we can't put a price on it anyway. But how much does it cost to hire helicopters, have them on standby for several days with the staff, and then the logistics of it, because of course we're talking about the jungles, and also moving the military out of a region, so making a de facto demilitarized zone to go and pick up Kevin Scott Sute. What are the costs involved of creating this change? Anyway, she wrote a very interesting, very insightful article about this. And I think it's called Backpacking in the Red Zone, something along that lines. And also you should read another one, and we'll discuss this too. I went to a couple of years ago, I attended a conference, a several day conference held by the military here in Colombia. And a lot of it was about social media and how they could then improve their standings amongst, the Colombian people through social media, through getting their message across. And one thing that you've noticed, and one thing that they all admitted, was that the guerrillas are light years ahead in terms of their use of social media, the internet, messages. to get out there and get their message across. The military really don't know how to use this. Kira's done a piece about this called Hashtag FARC, and that also should be read. So we'll be talking about these issues, and I hope if we have time, we'll be able to get on to the whole issue of what's happening with Gustavo Petro, the mayor of Bogota, who was kicked out, then, you know, it was found to be against the law, kicking him out, and so on and so forth. Anyway, so we'll be talking about all these really, really interesting topics that are going on in Colombia at the moment, and from the point of view of a journalist. So it'll be nice, a journalist talking to another journalist. You know, we're on a level playing field, talking about what's going on and the knowledge of how to tell a story. So yeah, don't go away. Yeah, you can check us out on www.columbiacallingradio.com, also our Twitter handle Columbia Calling, and obviously check out my blogs at richardmccall.com and my editorials. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and we'll be right back with Kira Gurney. Thank you.
OverseasRadio.com, broadcasting from Panama to Paris and beyond.
You've got questions about Colombia, and Escape Artist has answers. Is Colombia a good fit for me and my plans? How do I buy a house, find a job, find a doctor, start a business, invest in real estate? What should I know to better appreciate its history, its culture, its opportunities? What is it really like to be an expat in Colombia? You'll find your answers at colombia.escapeartist.com. Your complete and trusted guide for living, working, playing, investing, and retiring in Colombia. That's colombia.escapeartist.com.
You're listening to the Overseas Radio Network, the exclusive online radio station for the expatriate community.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, and I'm your host, Richard McCall, here on the Overseas Radio Network. And we're here with Kira Gurney, who's a U.S. Citizen from New Mexico originally, studied at Colorado College in Colorado, but she's been down in Colombia for a little while now. Even at a tender age of 23, she's been down here, making it happen in Colombia. And so we got together, and we're here to talk with her about why she came to Colombia and what she's doing here now. And so welcome on the show, Kira.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, I know from my research and from our small conversations that you were a Fulbright scholar.
I was. I was a Fulbright English teaching assistant in Tunja, Colombia.
And Tunja, explain to the listeners out there what this place is. Where is it, this town of Tunja?
So Tunja is up in the region of Boyacá, about 3 hours from Bogotá, depending on traffic. And it's at 9,000 feet. So I don't actually know how many meters that would be, but...
Is that higher than Bogotá?
Much higher, yes.
Much higher than Bogotá,
so
much colder.
Much colder, yes. And there aren't a lot of tourists in Tunja, so you kind of, you don't see a lot of foreigners there. So there were two of us from the Fulbright program, and we were probably two of the only foreigners in the city for a while.
Oh, that's cool. But Tunja, it's not a place that people visit frequently. They do pass through. They do pass through on the way to Villa de Leyva. Mm-hmm. But Tunja's really very colonial.
It is. It's very interesting. They have a lot of old colonial churches mm-hmm. with some really nice religious art. And they also have a system of tunnels underneath all of the churches that I was told were built during the when Colombia was fighting for independence, uh-huh. so the church could help hide people, and then used later during the period of La Violencia when the liberals and conservatives were killing each other.
Hey, that's something I didn't know. I didn't know at all about Tunja. No, that's very interesting. But there's a lot of very Baroque churches, right?
Yes.
And a lot of work by the Vasquez Arce y Ceballos, the maestro of Colombian mm-hmm. Religious art.
Yes.
And did this take up much of your time there in Tunja? Did you get to explore Tunja and really become, let's say, at one with this city, with this the capital of Boyacá?
So to be honest, I didn't know much about I hadn't visited many of the churches until mm-hmm. near the end of my year there. Mm-hmm. Kind of right before I left, I realized I hadn't seen a lot of the things there because I spent a lot of weekends going to Villa de Leyva, to smaller towns outside of Tunja, or coming to Bogota.
Yeah.
But yeah, near the end, I made a list of the churches I wanted to go see and... and the other colonial architecture.
So you did take advantage of this time there. And, and Fulbright looked after you. They made sure everything was okay. They approved you going to Tunja. You taught at the university, or?
I did. I taught at Universidad de Boyacá. Mm-hmm. It's a smaller private university. Mm-hmm. I taught English there part-time, and I worked with an NGO, Fundación Juventus, mm-hmm. part-time through their education programs for children.
And how did you find it teaching at a Colombian university here in a different town to like the capital of Boyacá or in Medellin or something mm-hmm. like that?
So I had to get used to a slightly slower pace of life because in the U.S. and I'm sure in England too, punctuality is very important. But with my students, you know, they would wander in 10, 15 minutes late. So I think it became a question of trying to find a good compromise between what I was used to and expected and what they were used to and expected. Uh-huh. So we kind of settled on, okay, you can come in up to 10 minutes late. After that, you know, you can't come in anymore.
And in terms of teaching, mm-hmm. How was the level of English when you entered, when you started teaching there? How was their level? Did it surprise you how good or how little they knew? I mean,
it really depended on the students. Mm-hmm. I taught some students who were taking English as a requirement to graduate. Weren't very excited about English. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely a struggle. But I also had a lot of students who were studying international business, and they take 6 semesters of English. So they reach a fairly high level. Some of them have had experiences studying abroad. And so I think it really depended on the class.
Ah, okay. And tell us a bit about the Fulbright. I mean, because it's a very prestigious award, this. I mean, you know, you're up there in the annals of various, you know, high and mighty students and politicians and so on and so forth who have all been Fulbright scholars. That's one of the things on all of these famous people's sort of, let's say, what they call hoja de vida, the curriculum, the resume. There we go. I'll get there eventually. It's been here too long. on their resume. So you're obviously destined for greatness. But how do you become a Fulbright scholar?
So you apply through your university, mm-hmm. And you apply to the program in Washington D.C. their offices, mm-hmm. and you have to do several interviews with different faculty members at the university. Submit a long application. Choose the country you're going to apply for. Because the Fulbright program has different programs mm-hmm. in many different countries throughout the world. And then you basically wait to hear back for about 6 months. And then you can make the first cut through, I believe it's the international education, like the government function that deals with international education that makes the first cut. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they send applications to the country, so to mm-hmm. the Fulbright Columbia offices, and they make the final decisions.
And why did you choose Colombia?
I had studied abroad in Argentina in high school, mm-hmm. and I spoke some Spanish, but I really wanted to keep working on my Spanish. Mm-hmm. I was a literature major, so I obviously Gabriel García Márquez, very interested in Colombia through his writing. Mm-hmm. And I also had a friend at the university who was Colombian from Bogota, mm-hmm. and would always tell me about how much she loved Colombia and missed it. So I think a combination of those things made me really interested in applying here.
Okay, so it all fell into place. You made the cut. You got the scholarship. You came down. You worked for, I guess, a year in Tunja. So you were there, and you were you know, teaching at the University of Boyacá, as you said, and in this Fundación Juventus. Tell us more about the Fundación, this NGO that you worked for.
They work with children from low-income families or children from families who've been internally displaced mm-hmm. in Colombia, because a lot of them end up in Boyacá. The government sends them there, I think mostly because it's a very safe region. Mm-hmm. And we were working with these children in a variety of different programs, mm-hmm. but one of the most interesting programs that the Fundación does is a human rights workshops for children in a lot of rural towns in Boyacá. Mm-hmm. And then I was working specifically with the English program. So we applied for a grant through the U.S. Embassy to fund an English language program in a small town, mm-hmm. Suraca, about 20 minutes outside of Tunja. Mm-hmm.
And of course you were well accepted and well received, and they didn't mind you coming in as a foreigner and an NGO, waving the flag, saying, mm-hmm. listen, we need to do this, we want to do this. They were very receptive.
Yes, they were. I think it helped that the NGO is run by Colombians. Uh-huh. A Colombian guy who actually is now working for the United Nations in Colombia. But he started the program. He's from Boyacá, so I think working with him definitely made a difference in terms of how I was received.
Oh, okay, well, that's very good. And of course, so this must have been a formative year. I mean, in your education. I mean, really, to come down at 22, do all of this, see all of this. And now you stayed on.
I did, yes. Yes, it definitely was a year of a big learning experience, yes. I moved to Bogota when I finished the Fulbright in July. And I've been teaching English part-time here and working with the city paper. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get my foot in the door in journalism, so I've been writing articles here. And I also, my boyfriend is from Tunja, but he lives in Bogota, so that was definitely a factor in staying.
Oh, of course, of course. Well, it's so good to hear this. I mean, this is a nice story that we're illustrating here. We can't promote you, but this is a nice story to hear. I mean, you quite clearly, your life was changed by a trip to Colombia, by this study period in Colombia, and now you've decided to stay. And to all those naysayers out there saying, no, there's nothing to be done in Colombia, we can't do anything. Look, listen to Kira. Story. Fulbright scholar, working with an NGO, teaching English, I believe first at the Wall Street Institute, mm-hmm. and which is a big English training, a sort of business English almost, and now at the Universidad Pontificia Javeriana, which we say is the Javeriana University, which is again amongst the top ones in the country. And I mean, you've clearly made your mark. You're clearly a sought after commodity, because it's not anyone who gets in to teach English at the Javeriana. You're teaching, the elite of Colombia society.
Well, I think in that case, persistence paid off, because I've been applying with them since July of last year, and then I applied again in December. So I keep bugging them until they finally hired me.
Well, this is good. Again, so there we go. So to all of you who think of coming to Colombia, persistence.
Definitely.
And of course, a little bit of a liberal timekeeping. So we're talking to Kira Gurney, who's a young lady from New Mexico, who's here now living in Bogota. She's been in Colombia for about a year and a half now, or almost 2 years, mm-hmm. I should say. And we're talking about how she's made it here, how she's made a life, how she's continuing a life. And so we'll come back to her in the next segment of this show. Don't go away. I'm Richard McCall, and this is Colombia Calling.
Pack your bags and explore the world with us. You're listening to the Overseas Radio Network.
Worried about rising taxes, costly insurance, out-of-control health care, economic decline, staggering debt, mortgages, and retirement? It doesn't have to be this way. Escape to Ecuador, one of the most beautiful countries on the planet, and at EcuadorAtYourService.com, be your guide. Ecuador has been named the number one retirement destination in the world 3 times in a row. So if you're searching for beaches, jungles, farmland, cities, affordable healthcare, and a richer lifestyle at half the cost, contact EcuadorAtYourService.com.
You're tuned in to OverseasRadio.com, the station to help you reach your dream destination.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm your host, Richard McCall, and we're talking to Kira Gurney, a native of New Mexico, who's now a resident in Bogota. And we've been talking about her Fulbright time there in Tunja, in Boyacá, which is a few hours outside of Bogota. A city worth visiting, but not to spend perhaps a year in. But anyway, that's, she'll no doubt say, no, Tunja's wonderful, but that's okay. I know you got under the skin of Tunja and everything like that. But let's move on a little bit and say, you're trying to get your foot into the door in a career in journalism. And that's why you are producing three to four articles a month for the Anglo newspaper here called The City Paper.
Yes. Yeah, so I started working a little bit with The City Paper last year in April. From Tunja, writing a couple articles, working with Richard, and then when I moved to Bogota in July, I started working a little bit more with them.
Okay, and so you have no background in journalism, but you have a background in literature, so you obviously this helps you as a cronista,
yes.
More literary journalism and understanding, let's say, how to formulate a story, how to put it together and how to engage the reader. And that shows in some of the articles that you've written that I've read. I mean, obviously all of the articles are very, very good, but I remember you did big pieces on Tunja, and one article that's really stood out was you did a piece on a recent book released about the Chiquita, the United Fruit Company up there on the Atlantic coast.
Yes, so there's a Colombian man who's doing, I think he just finished his doctoral research in the U.S. and for his final PhD thesis, I guess, he wrote about the history of the Chiquita Banana Company, but from kind of the perspective of business history. Mm-hmm. So looking more at what their relationship was with their shareholders, what their relationship was with the local government where they were operating. Mm-hmm. So a very different perspective than what we usually hear about with Chiquita Banana, which is generally, or United Fruit, which mm-hmm. is what they were before, which is generally more related to their human rights abuses.
Okay, so. And what was, after reading that book and, you know, making some sort of taking your own conclusions, what mm-hmm. you know, what conclusions did you reach out of this? What did you say? Well, it's not all about massacres.
Right. No, and I think that was definitely the main point of the book. But I found it a little bit hard to forget all of that bloody history, because not just in Colombia, but also in Central America, the United Fruit Company caused a lot of problems.
Well, of course, I mean, when you had Dulles more or less owning the railways through Central America mm-hmm. and then leasing them back to the United Fruit Company for like a dollar a kilometer and stuff.
Right.
I mean, the favorable business model that was exploited, all through the region. But mm-hmm. Very interesting that you should be picking up on this stuff. And reporting it as well in the city paper, because Richard Emlyn, who's been on the show, last year, one of the first interviewees we had, who's a stalwart of let's say the Bogota and Colombia journalism field here, he's been here for 19, 20, many years. Mm-hmm. I don't say it how many, but. He set up the city paper back in 2007, 2008, if I'm not mistaken, to push more positive news about Colombia. But then there you are writing a review of a book about the United Fruit Company Chiquita brand, which is never going to be too positive.
Right. It's definitely a very dark legacy, I think, in Colombia in general. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think the city paper has a lot of very positive news, a lot of information about art exhibits, cultural activities. But I think it's impossible to completely avoid, what's going on here with political situation and also kind of some of the historical legacy.
I think I think you're incredibly, on the right area here, because it's true. To understand Colombia, to promote Colombia, to talk about Colombia, we have to get in touch with what's happened in Colombia. There's no way that we can, deny everything that's happened. This is a very present history mm-hmm. that's taken place, and even as your literary studies mm-hmm. back at Colorado mm-hmm. College will, of course, fare you well. Doing 100 years of solitude and the mention of the banana massacre there in Cienega Grande, up mm-hmm. there in between Santa Marta and Barranquilla. So yes, of course, it's very important to talk about these things. And I think sometimes it's better that we talk about it as foreigners, because Colombians would prefer to push it behind them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Have you found this in your research and in your reporting?
Yes, I think there's a sense sometimes that talking to Colombians, Colombian friends, that they are a little anxious about talking to foreigners about these things, because they think Colombia has a very negative image in the United States especially. And I think that's definitely changing. Mm-hmm. My experience coming to Colombia is that most friends and family express interest in coming to visit. Mm-hmm. It's not asking, oh my gosh, are you going to be safe? That's kind of a thing of the past. But I do think that sometimes it's hard to talk to Colombians about the political situations here, because they don't want to kind of bring attention to the problems here.
I think it's true, but of course, like we say, we can mm-hmm. say with this, with perhaps a naivety of a foreigner here, these things need to be addressed.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. again, I read that article about the Chiquita brand, with great aplomb, and I congratulate you on that, Massa. Now, and also, I think that you've been focusing on some things as well about the FARC and the ongoing, let's say, the peace dialogues taking place in Havana at the moment between the FARC, that's the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, or the United Armed Forces of mm-hmm. the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, as they're called, who've been in. For those of you who are not as familiar as Kira and I, they've been in a struggle for more than 50 years against the Colombian establishment. Their whole setup is really around agrarian reform. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really their base, their core value. Mm-hmm. The dialogues are set around 6 points. Is that
I
right?
think there's six.
Six
yes.
points, which are, one of them is about the narco trafficking and drugs
right.
trade, and then there's
political participation.
But you've been talking a little bit about this, and you, we, you know, it's an interesting
a very interesting subject that we should bring up that we've never talked about on Columbia Calling, mm-hmm. is that the FARC are light years ahead in terms of using social media to expand their audience and get their message across. And you wrote a piece called Hashtag FARC.
Yes, yeah, I started following Ivan Marquez, one of the negotiators in Havana on FARC. And it's very interesting. FARC has they use their blog quite often. They have a Facebook page. And they also, a lot of the FARC commanders, especially the negotiators, have their own Twitter accounts. Mm-hmm. So they will tweet about everything from what they're talking about at the negotiating table that day to soccer matches. And oftentimes, especially Ivan Marquez, will talk about what's going on in Colombia using soccer metaphors, which I find is kind of interesting.
Well, it's well known, and even amongst the military, it's well known that the FARC and the FARC guerrillas, even from their low rank and file up to mm-hmm. the secretariat, love soccer or football, mm-hmm. if you're from the UK. They absolutely love it, and so the government takes full advantage of this on the radio broadcasts of soccer games. There are adverts that pop up in the middle saying, guerrillero, guerrilla, demobilize, yeah. etc. And even on the TVs, I don't know how many guerrillas are watching TVs out there in the jungle, because of course the Colombian military and whoever else is helping them have great big satellite dishes to find these TV seasons. So I imagine they're listening to it on small wireless apparatus out there, but they always have these this propaganda from the government side, and so Ivan Marquez is always using soccer terminology, mm-hmm. not something I was aware of. I do not follow Ivan Marquez on
and I hadn't before I wrote this article, and now I'm wondering if in my country the National Security Agency is now tapping into my emails.
I'm sure you're gonna have to encrypt everything, aren't
I'm
you?
Sure. but yeah, it's been very interesting. Well, and he, when there was the agrarian strike in August, he was saying that the football game of a lifetime was being staged with the agrarian strike, but I was talking to a professor at the Javeriana, who's a professor of communications, and he was telling me that that's very common in Colombia with politicians to use soccer as kind of a way of connecting with their constituents.
Well, it's going to be the opiate of the masses, isn't it?
Right, of course.
Everybody follows soccer.
Right.
Everybody follows. I mean, look at how many people have been lamenting the injury of Falcao.
Oh my goodness! Yeah,
he's on an Achilles tendon or a cruciate ligament.
Crossed ligament, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Which is going to keep him out of the World Cup. You don't recover in time mm-hmm. and be fit for the World Cup. Unfortunately, it's very bad news. And I saw, in fact, while I don't follow Ivan Marquez, for some reason or other, I do follow Alvaro Uribe.
Okay.
Because he's always out there saying something.
Right.
Let's say he's a bugbear in everybody's side. And so I like to follow him because I like to see these outrageous statements.
Of course.
Anyway, he's going to he was praying for Falcao the other day.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
And I did read this morning that Santos will be visiting Falcao as well when he's in Portugal. So he will be going out to visit. It's actually, we can say this is the sort of message that gets all the way through Colombia.
It does.
The football message, the soccer message. So it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
So who else in the ruling secretariat and the negotiating team do you follow?
So mostly just Ivan Marquez, but I also will occasionally check out the FARC's, their blog, because they post a lot of information on there, especially in relation to the peace negotiations. Mm-hmm. They always have their side of the negotiations, a lot of accusations against the government. So,
but do you find it easy to wade through that the sort of opening paragraphs of propaganda, the whole thing, the great imperialist struggle against the neo-imperial oligarchs?
Right.
And
I definitely skim the first few paragraphs, yes.
Because then you have to get down to the crux of the information. I do look at it a bit, and I think that I'm probably on a watch list for my the IP
I'm
addresses
sure.
as well. So, well, that's an interesting. But I went to a congress that was hosted by the military about social media, and there were experts in communications talking about social media and how the military should be sort of upgrading their practice and how to get the message mm-hmm. across. And as I said, the FARC are just so much further ahead. How, if you were thinking about it as a journalist and as someone who's studied this, because mm-hmm. you wrote the piece, hashtag FARC, You know, how would you say to the military, what would your advice be? And, you know, how should they engage more followers and people to understand what they're doing?
Well, I think, you know, we were talking earlier, you made a good point, which is that the military usually, their communications are six people died in this region of the country today in a, you know, an armed struggle or whatever. Whereas Ivan Marquez really connects, he tries to connect with the people who are following him. So he talks about soccer. He talks about supporting the rural poor in Colombia. You know, he's always kind of pushing the same narrative. Mm-hmm. I think also the FARC have a very cohesive message. Mm-hmm. So no matter who's tweeting or who's blogging, you know, they're all on the same page. So I guess I would say that the military would try to maybe connect with people a little bit more, maybe even the soccer.
Well, it's very interesting that. And where do we think they're tweeting from? Where are these IP addresses?
I think Ivan Marquez is just tweeting from Havana. You know, I imagine him negotiating, like everyone else is talking, and he's sitting there on his iPhone or
he's the irritating
BlackBerry.
One.
Exactly.
With his WhatsApp, you know.
Exactly, and the negotiator has to ask him questions twice because he wasn't paying attention. And,
I like the image of that, someone slapping Ivan Marquez's hand.
Exactly. No, because sometimes he'll tweet like 20, 30 times a day while he's at the negotiating table. Yeah.
You've really been following this.
I have,
We're talking to Kira Gurney, who's a trainee journalist here in Colombia, originally from New Mexico. We're talking all about everything in Colombia. We're talking about the FARC guerrillas. We're talking about life in Tunja, and we'll come back and we'll continue to talk with her about her articles in a city paper and elsewhere. And so this is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Please don't go away.
Your expatriation destination. This is OverseasRadio.com.
Searching for freedom? The sustainable community in Chile is found at FreedomOrchard.com. Quiet, peaceful, and pristine are some of Freedom Orchard's outstanding features. Freedom Orchard offers recreational activities, organic farming, and self-sufficiency for water and electricity. Well-known Chile expert, free market economist, and radio host of Red Hot Chile, Dr. John Coben, is heading a team of developers, organic farmers, and seasoned professionals to make Freedom Orchard a reality. FreedomOrchard.com, for when you're serious about your freedom.
Sit back and relax. You are tuned into the Overseas Radio Network.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm your host, Richard McCall. We're talking to Kira Gurney. And we've been talking about social media and its sort of its influences in the Colombian conflict. We've been talking primarily about the FARC and how they are streets ahead of the Colombian establishment regarding social media and perhaps what the military can do to, you know, pull themselves up to speed. But we're going to move back onto journalism a bit more rather than social media, because everything's social media and tweeting and Facebooking and everything else nowadays. So, Kira, you wrote a piece called Backpacking in a Red Zone. And this piece was about the American former Marine who went just walking off without, you know, everyone had said don't do it. The police had pleaded with him in Guaviare, in the department where he was, to not go out and do it. And so you wrote a piece about this, largely dealing with the economics of a rescue.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about this piece, where, you know, with the inspiration and what you wrote.
So I started researching what was going on with the Kevin Scott Sute, the Marine, and he had recently been released, and I started looking at what had gone into his rescue, and I talked to Jordi Raich, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, from the Red Cross in Colombia, and he was explaining everything that goes into a rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also kind of researching why Kevin Scott Sute had gone into that region, and he had been told, as you mentioned, repeatedly not to go there, that it was FARC territory, and he'd kind of gone anyway. And so I was researching some other travelers in other parts of the world who have done similar things, you know, gone into Iran or gone into Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's obviously a huge trauma for someone who gets kidnapped and for their family, but it also has huge political repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very expensive, not just financially, but politically, for organizations like the Red Cross to organize these kinds of rescue missions.
Mm-hmm. And so what do we think went into, you know, economically, well, into the cost of rescuing Kevin Scott Sute there in Guaviare?
So the Red Cross wasn't willing to give me a figure. Their main line is that, you know, it's worth any cost, which is of course true, to rescue someone in that kind of a situation. But I do know that they had to rent a helicopter to do this, and then they had, you know, I think something like 12 people working full-time for at least a month before this, figuring out all the logistics, because logistically it's very complicated.
And of course the weather down there is so changeable, because it's where the savannas and the plains meet the Amazon. Mm-hmm. So you're getting weather patterns that are blowing in at any time, or heavy rain, so the things have to be cancelled, and then the coordinates need to be changed, and a ceasefire needs to be agreed between the military, mm-hmm, and of course the guerrillas as well, so that this can go off without incident. I mean, it's not a small endeavor. You're not just saying, we're going to hand over this guy.
Right. And at least with what the FARC had reported in their blog about Kevin Sute, he was very blasé about the whole situation. He had said, you know, I've worked in war zones before. I believe he'd been deployed to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, there's always a war going on somewhere. I'm just going to go ahead and go. It's not going to be a problem. So I think what I was trying to, you know, investigate and show a little bit is that it is a big issue for not just the person who's kidnapped and their family, but for all of the governments and the organizations that have to negotiate their release.
And of course, one of the key things that came out of this is that you know, when the government were asking for sort of, you know, so that a generation of trust and some sort of act of goodwill, which are key in any form of negotiations, mm-hmm, and any form of sort of conflict resolution. Kevin Scott Sute became that act of goodwill. That was his release. And of course, perhaps, had he not been kidnapped, there would be some other Colombians who had been held in captivity would have been released instead. Some, mm-hmm, other people who'd been held for maybe 10 years, maybe 8 years, maybe 6 years, maybe 2 years, but Colombians themselves. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I mean, this raises all sorts of doubts. You know, it's like all this money was invested into rescuing a man who, against, you know, that, as you said, he was repeatedly asked, mm-hmm, begged with, pleaded with, you know, to not go.
Right.
And, you know, see, we've got to think about this. It's like, well, then why did he do it?
Exactly. And so, as you mentioned, you know, there are people who are being held who happen to be in what we call here red zones, mm-hmm, areas with a lot of, for those of you who don't know, for a lot of military activity or FARC activity, dangerous areas. There are a lot of people who are in those regions for work reasons, mm-hmm, because they work for a mining company or they have to go on some sort of government mission. People who aren't necessarily choosing to be there. So, yeah, you do. I think that's a very good point that people need to, travelers who don't have to be in those regions really should take that into consideration.
Yes, I've been down to Guaviare. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few places I've been to, along with Caquetá, where you feel the aggression straight away. You know you're not in a safe area. You, mm-hmm, know that something's going on. The army, the police, they're more, you know, on edge. They're, as you say, probably a bit more trigger happy, you, mm-hmm, know, or they are continually warning you about where not to go, what, mm-hmm, to do. You have to check in, and every day they check on who's arrived in the hotels. I mean, we're talking these frontier towns,
right,
between the influence of the state and the influence of the guerrilla.
Mm-hmm.
And he went off and did it. But anyway, Kevin Scott is now at home, you know, sipping iced tea in whichever state he's from, and that's over. And those of you out there listening, can, you know, you could take a pen and piece of paper and think how much it's going to cost to rent a helicopter, to contract people, mm-hmm, and the logistics, and see, you know, you could take a ballpark figure and get an idea of how much
it
costs.
Quite expensive, yeah.
If a German citizen is kidnapped, mm-hmm, and on their, you know, sort of Ministry of Foreign Affairs page, it says you shouldn't go to that region, the German government will pay the reward, but then you have to pay back the German government.
So
there's a German lady still paying back her, mm-hmm, rescue fee from when she went up years ago up into the up to the Lost City, and she was kidnapped.
Okay.
You know, they did a rescue fee and everything, etc. They got their citizen out again. But this lady will be paying off the debt for the rest of her life.
Wow.
I think there's something, you know, I think there's something telling about that.
Yeah, I think you have to think about the implications for other people when you make the decision to travel really far off the beaten path.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true. But for the most part, you can travel Colombia without any issue.
Definitely.
Without even knowing that there's a conflict in place.
Right, and there are so many beautiful, safe places to visit here that I think, you know, it's it's important to stick to those places. If you're going to get off the beaten track a little bit, go to Mompox or something like that. That's very safe. But not all the way out into the jungle in Guaviare.
Now, you've been writing as well. You've been writing about the situation taking place unfolding here in Bogota with our mayor, Gustavo Petro, the former guerrilla elected to mayor, then, you know, kicked out as mayor, then brought back in. But that's the newest piece of information.
Right.
The attorney general, it's more or less what it is, mm-hmm. Ordóñez, has been found, you know, that what he kicked him out for was not legitimate, etc., etc. Okay. Explain to our listeners a little bit about what's going on.
Yeah, so to be honest, I found it a bit confusing, you know, to follow, because every day there's a new piece of news. But so for those of you who don't know, back in December, the Attorney General or Inspector General, that figure, ousted the mayor, Gustavo Petro, and banned him from politics for 15 years, which is a pretty heavy sanction. Mm-hmm. And the reason for this, according to Ordóñez, was that Petro deprivatized the garbage collection system in Bogota, and there were some glitches, you know, with switching from these private companies, which Petro claimed had mafia ties, to this government system. So for a few days, trash wasn't picked up in the city, and the Procurador General, the Ordóñez, used that as an excuse, according to some people, or as a legitimate reason, according to others, to get rid of Petro.
And his claim was that Petro had put Bogotanos' lives at risk.
Right.
Which is incredibly difficult to prove with such immediacy.
Right.
I mean, because this is a long-term thing. I mean, epidemiologists are going to have to study that from years later to see the incidences of illnesses that would have, you know, like surged forth mm-hmm. from a lack of waste collection. And also, let's just get something out there. Bogota is not a clean city.
No.
Every night, the trash is strewn along the streets as the recicladores, mm-hmm. the recyclers, that are really, let's say, I hasten not to add the word underclass, but it's an underbelly of Bogota mm-hmm. society that come through, that fish through the trash to look for metals and, mm-hmm. and cardboard and other things that they can use and sell.
Right.
And that's our form of recycling here.
Right.
And so they leave it all strewn out on the pavements. Mm-hmm. So surely, you know, we could address that as being a health problem for the Bogota city.
Definitely. And I think, you know, no matter what your political views are or how you see the role of the Inspector General, who, you know, his job is ostensibly to get rid of corrupt politicians, mm-hmm. the sanction of 15 years is just ridiculous, because mm-hmm. the former mayor was implicated in a huge corruption scandal. He'd supposedly, I think, embezzled a lot of money related to the public transportation system here. And he was, I think, sanctioned for 6 months originally, mm-hmm. ended up being closer to a year. Whereas Petro is 15 years, you know.
Do we think that there are political motivations behind the Inspector General in this one? Do we think there are interests?
I mean, for my personal opinion, yes, but I think so. I think they're definitely, Ordóñez is completely opposed politically to Petro. Ordóñez is, you know, very conservative, very Catholic. Petro, as you mentioned, is a former guerrilla fighter, M19. Yes, but, you know, as I'm trying to investigate the situation, I'm trying to also talk to the garbage companies that were kind of kicked out of their contracts and, yeah.
But, I mean, you know, we can look back through history at the sort of, almost through any city's history, and a lot of the garbage companies have been associated with mafias.
Yes.
I mean, if we just look at Cleveland, for example, there's even a movie about it. It's called, mm-hmm. I think, Kill Irish or something like that.
Yes.
At Cleveland, New York, we know. I'm certain.
Or you watch The Sopranos, you know, the whole thing is related to their sanitation companies. Yeah.
Everything is about it. And of course, the privatization, it didn't help Bogota at all. I mean,
right.
It didn't help. And, you know, Petro is not a great politician.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know how to play off each side. He doesn't know how to maintain friendships, but at the same time work with people. He gets in their faces, mm-hmm. and I think this is a big problem. I think, you know,
he makes a lot of enemies.
He makes a lot of enemies, and I think he's ending up making enemies amongst his own people too.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, stop being so obtuse.
Right.
It's like you've got a vast support base. You're the first mayor to really have taken into account the poor south of Bogota,
mm-hmm.
which it really is a great big social divide between
the
Calle de los Comuneros, you know, the Calle Sexta, I think it
mm-hmm.
is, which just divides, let's say, the center from the south. And he's the first person to really go out there and say, listen, we've got to address this.
Right. We've got to address inequality in this city.
And it needs to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, if this is going to become a first-rate international city, and, you know, okay, great, there's big investment in the north, and Hilton's building another hotel, and Marriott's building another hotel, but what of the south? And that's where all of displaced people are going, and the reinsertados, mm-hmm. and the desmovilizados, and everything. You know, this is someone who's addressing the situation in Colombia as a whole, but within Bogota.
Yeah.
And of course, now Bogota's being laughed at by every other city in Colombia.
Right.
So I don't know where it's going to go, but it's like a soap opera at the moment.
It is, and it's this never-ending saga, because the latest news from yesterday is that the court in Colombia has decided to accept what's called a tutela here, mm-hmm. Kind of a legal intervention that they're going to at least freeze the sanction against Petro until another court can look at it.
Hmm. And which court will be looking at it?
So I believe the court that's going to look at it, the final court, or the jueces administrativos, mm-hmm. the administrative judges, have to make the final decision. But according to El Tiempo, that could take 5 years.
It could take 5 years. So we could be in this for 5 years.
Exactly.
And the international sort of American Court mm-hmm. of Human Rights has got involved too. I mean, just to muddy things up further.
Right. So Petro has asked them to intervene, and a couple other politicians who have had problems with the Inspector General have also asked this court to intervene. So I think, as far as I know, they're still deciding whether or not they're going to formally intervene.
I mean, it's a tough one, because they can say things, but our national government and courts, they don't have to follow what
exactly,
they say.
Exactly, yeah.
It's all linked, as we say. It's all mm-hmm. linked, and it would be better off in an international circumstance if Colombia did take, did pay attention to what's going on, rather than saying, no, this is Colombia, this is our problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, very interesting times in Colombia, never a dull moment.
And that's true.
Kira, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And you've been, mm-hmm. you know, incredibly informative mm-hmm. and helping us learn more, and listeners out there understand what's going on in Colombia, not only from a Boyacá background, but also from Bogota. And how long do you plan on spending here in Colombia?
So I'm actually not sure yet. I guess it's a little bit up in the air, but at least for probably another year.
Ah, there we go. It's good to hear. It's good to hear. And so thank you again for being on the show. This is Colombia Calling. You can check us out at ColombiaCallingRadio.com. I'm Richard McCall. Thank you for listening.
Live call-in shows and hosts from your favorite countries. This is the Overseas Radio Network.